absurdest thing, the Pâté Physique in France, you know, and so on. Ever since Jarry hit town in Paris, they loved stuff that didn't make any sense. Maybe it makes sense when you translate it into French. Maybe that's like Poe, when, you know, was it Baudelaire who translated Poe, you know, and made him a great writer in France? Maybe I'm a great writer in France because I've got good translators.
You are better known, I think, sometimes in France than you are here.
In Germany, France, in England, too. They're not translated, though. See, I mean, we speak the same.
Yeah.
You understand?
Two nations separated by
They spell curb with a K there.
Yeah.
That's the only difference.
What do they think of Man in the High Castle in Germany?
Oh, that's heavy. Heavy. They didn't know I could read German. They bought it. A publisher bought it in Germany. And began to translate, and I learned of it, the fact that they bought it. I mean, said, oh no, you're not going to print that in Germany without letting me see the German translation. Says, you get that in the contract, Scott. You insist, and Scott is Jewish. And I says, listen, Scott, we're not going to let them publish that book lest I read the galleys. It's got to be a sine qua non. It's got to be conditioned. And he said, I agree with you completely. And they phoned Germany, and they asked for immediately the galleys. Well, they didn't have galleys. They still just had the typescript manuscript. And they had to send it to us. We made it a condition of the contract. And I got a chance to read it, because I couldn't read German. And I started reading that thing, and they had destroyed that book. They left whole scenes out. Whole basic scenes to speed up the action. They had it just turned into a travesty of itself. And I wrote them a letter that they went out of business after they published it, too. You know, like I actually burst into tears when I finished reading it. I actually cried at what they, see, there was my best novel, right? I mean, really. And they said, we didn't know you could read German. They actually said that in their letter. They gave me 5 days to read it. That's how they thought. They had 5 days. They said, well, German can't be fluent enough so they can read the whole darn thing in 5 days. But my German got very fluent at that point. I just stayed up night and day with my Cassell's German English Dictionary, and I read every single word, and I compared it line by line with English. And I marked the parts they'd cut out, the parts they had changed. They hadn't changed any of the political parts. All the anti-Nazi stuff was still there. They had just cheapened it into a cheap adventure novel, fast action, fast-paced adventure novel. I remember one part says, Untergomi of Nazis in Germany. Mr. Tagomi, he is like Wyatt Earp. Isn't that dreadful? The whole thing was that way.
What about Japan?
There is a Japanese edition. I can't read it. I can read the titles of my English novels in the bio section in the back, and they have, so help me, I'm not putting you on. I don't mean this as a slur against the Japanese, but they said in the English titles, Valuable Man, instead of Variable Man. That's their problem. But I can't read the Japanese edition. Oh, I wrote the translator. Somebody suggested I write the translator, Japanese translator, and ask him specific questions about the book, and I could tell something about the Japanese edition that way. And he wrote back, and he was really, I thought the Japanese was supposed to be very polite, because I was really wrong. He says, first of all, he says, your book wasn't any good to start with. And he says, secondly, you confuse Chinese culture and Japanese culture. Chinese are inferior people, and then Yi Jing is Chinese and not Japanese. There's no Japanese would ever use a Confucian classic. So it's only foreigners use those. And he went on like that. And I was really amazed, you know, how upfront he was in his contempt for the book. But the book is still in print in Japan. It sold very well. I made almost $30, $35 off it. Over a 10-year period. I almost got a check for 40 cents. And Scott had taken 2 cents out. It was 42 cents. It was a book that sold in Tanganyika or someplace like that. Really, no kidding. One copy. And my royalty was 42 cents, and Scott took out 2 cents and sent me a check for 40 cents. And you know that I was so broke I cashed it? I wrote dirty words in the back of it for a long time. You know, I wasn't going to cash it. You know, and I finally went up to the 7-Eleven, you know, and bought a Manhandler meat pie or something. Hand over a 40-cent check, royalty check. I'm telling you,
they took it.
Well, they kind of laughed at me, but they always laughed at me at 7-Eleven anyway, because my checks always bounced. At least this check didn't bounce. it seems like Scott's check. One time, four guys from the 7-Eleven showed up at the front door with $285 worth of bad checks I'd written to the 7-Eleven. They said, you got till 5 o'clock to make them good, or you're going to the DA's office. They said, you're going to get in the car now, and we're going to ride around till 5 o'clock. And we did. And I borrowed it from my insurance agent. State Farm, insurance agent, loaned me the money to pay them. That's the life of the day.
And the next book you've got coming out, Phil, is Scanner Darkly?
Yeah.
Anything like the Cordlander Smith scanners? Or?
No, I don't know. I didn't know anybody used that in the title. What does that mean?
Scanners Live in Vain. One of it was his first, Cordlander Smith's first SF story.
Suffer and Succotash. Does that mean I got to change my title?
I don't think so. He's dead.
No, that isn't an issue at hand. Well, I know he's dead. That wasn't even his name. No, Scanner Darkly, it's from Paul's We See It Through a Glass Darkly. It's a story about a guy who becomes a narcotics agent and then begins to narc on himself. He rigs up a scanner, an infrared scanner, in his own home. And while he's in the home, he feels he's being watched. And then when he goes, to the safe house, he watches reels and reels of tape, video, hologram tape, it's set in the future, of what he was doing in the house. And he's so spaced out by the dope he's been taking as an undercover agent that he doesn't know he's narcing on himself. He thinks he's two different guys. And when his superiors point out to him that he's really the same guy that he's been reporting on, he flies into a terrible rage, and they fire him. And then he's got to come off the dope because he can't afford to buy it anymore because he didn't have any more money. And his brain is all burned out. And Julie Lynn Del Rey helped me put the book back together so it made more sense. And one of the things that I wrote was this funny suicide scene. I really think there should be more funny suicide things written. I mean, I think that it's a topic of great humor. And this is it. It's very short. It's an insert into the book, and it's self-explanatory, I hope. I hope the whole book makes sense. Dewey says it makes sense now. But we'll have the first full-length novel that makes sense. The scene goes as follows. Charles Freck, becoming progressively more and more depressed by what was happening to everyone he knew, decided finally to off himself. There was no problem in the circles where he hung out in putting an end to yourself. You just bought into a large quantity of reds and took them with some cheap wine late at night with the phone off the hook so that no one could interrupt you. The planning part had to do with the artifacts you wanted found on you by later archaeologists, so they'd know from which stratum you came, and also could piece together where your head had been at the time you did it. He spent several days deciding on the artifacts, much longer